Most of us are familiar with vitamin supplements. However, some vitamins need to be injected, which can be a hassle. Now, a knowledge-based company has produced an oral form of one of these vitamins, saving many of us from the pain of sticking needles. This pharmaceutical company has produced the first oral form of a vitamin B complex that was typically only found in an injectable form. This company also operates out of Pardis Science and Technology Park. It is also one of the first and largest knowledge-based companies. It might be interesting to know that this company mainly produces raw materials such as probiotic products needed in the pharma industry. Such productions have saved the country millions on imports so far. Knowledge-based productions are driven by scientific discoveries, and Iranian scientists produce roughly 2% of the world's scientific articles. That's according to the Minister of Science, Research and Technology. Mohammad Ali Zulfigol says Iran, on average, registers around 70,000 scientific articles in international journals each year. He says Iran is now globally ranked 15th for the number of scientific papers it produces. Zulfigol noted the quality ranking of Iranian articles in the top 10 fields like technology and engineering. The minister highlighted that the nation ranks 5th in nanotechnology publications as well. The official further added that those publishing academic articles also work in knowledge-based companies, helping produce quality products in the competitive field. And with that, we come to the end of this segment. You can contact us with your thoughts and comments via email. And don't forget, you can also send us topics you're interested in. Thank you for tuning in, and join us next week, same time, for another edition of Bazaar. It's bye for now. Until then.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has acknowledged that hundreds of schools in England are suffering from crumbling concrete. The Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been accused of failure to fund a programme to replace ageing classrooms. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Irish Times has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Education Minister warned on Monday that hundreds more school buildings in England might be crumbling and unsafe for pupils after authorities announced more than 150 British schools are at risk of collapse. Britain's Secretary of State for Education, Gillian Keegan, said the government was still waiting on responses from around 10% of the 15,000 schools in England that were sent surveys to identify those at risk. This comes after authorities ordered 104 schools to shut buildings with old and weak concrete to close because of safety concerns. More than 150 schools have been found to contain buildings made from reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, which has been assessed to be at risk of collapse after exceeding its 30-year lifespan. The lightweight form of reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete was widely used for walls, floors, and ceilings during the 1960s through to 1980s, but now it is considered weak and unsafe for construction purposes. Gillian Keegan said schools that were suspected to have RAAC, that is reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, would be inspected in the next 2 weeks. She told an interview with BBC, most of them won't have RAAC. It could be hundreds more. The British government has claimed the majority of the currently affected schools would still be able to operate largely normally. The revelations of crumbling school buildings just days before the start of a new term has sparked anger among parents and teachers and represents a new political headache for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservative government. The crumbling school buildings issue has added to the impression of decaying public infrastructure in Britain. An official in the former government put the blame for the shortcomings in British schools on Rishi Sunak, who in his previous job as finance minister had halved annual funding to repair schools when the education department had asked for it to be doubled. Former permanent secretary Jonathan Slater told the BBC, "We were saying there is a critical risk to life if this programme is not funded properly. I was absolutely amazed to see the decision made by the government." The opposition Labour Party said the Conservative government has not taken repeated warnings about crumbling schools seriously. It charged Rishi Sunak with putting children's lives at risk by refusing to approve what needed to be spent to fix the problem. The scandals that Rishi Sunak's government has been facing its worst economic issues in decades. Also, British workers in various sectors, including transportation, healthcare, and schools, are in dire economic straits. The workers have gone on repeated strikes over the past year because of low wages and rising cost of living crisis. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. UK teachers suggested more British children are likely to arrive at school this term with unclean clothes and unbrushed teeth. According to an opinion poll, nearly 3 in 4 or 72% of school staff believe there has been an increase in hygiene poverty issues in their school over the past year. The survey of 500 school staff in the United Kingdom who had said they were aware of pupils experiencing hygiene poverty, suggests that 71% expect the level of hygiene poverty to have increased at the start of the school year this month. Dirty school uniforms and PE kits, unwashed hair and unclean teeth were the most cited indicators of hygiene poverty by school staff questioned in June. The opinion poll carried out for charity The Hygiene Bank and cleaning brand Small defines hygiene poverty as those who are caught between being able to heat their home, pay their bills, buy food, or keep clean. Some of the school staff reported personally washing uniforms and PE kits for children at home and handing out laundry detergent for families in need. The survey, which was conducted by market research platform Attest, suggests that 72% of school staff said they had seen pupils affected by hygiene poverty experience low self-esteem. Meanwhile, 53% of school staff said their pupils were isolated or left out by other pupils in class, and 50% said they had seen a negative impact on mental health for those experiencing hygiene poverty. More than a quarter, or 26% of school staff, said they had seen absenteeism as a result of hygiene poverty. One respondent said students are often left with no desk partner in class. Makes it awkward for staff members to deal with the situation. Students are often faced with working alone. Other students make nasty comments about them in front of the class to single them out. Other students make nasty comments about them in front of the class to single them out. Another respondent said they had a feeling of powerlessness, that they could not do more. Sarah Smith, executive head teacher of St. Cuthbert's Catholic Academy, a primary school in Blackpool in northwest England, said, "We have seen an increase in students coming to school with unwashed uniforms, and we know that this has an effect on their mental health and overall well-being, which in turn will have a negative impact on their education." Brand Small, in collaboration with the Hygiene Bank, is hoping to expand its Suds in Schools initiative, which provides mini laundrettes to schools so more families in need are provided with clean clothes. Suds in Schools want to raise £25,000 to establish an additional 25 laundrettes in British schools. Lucy Wishart of Small said, "With hygiene poverty increasing, it's more important than ever for us to support more schools." She added, "We believe that everyone should have access to clean clothes in order to live their life to the fullest, and our research shows just how much this can impact young people at a crucial stage in their academic and social lives." Julie McCulloch, Director of Policy at the Association of School and College Leaders, said, "Hygiene poverty is linked to very high levels of deprivation as families struggle with the cost of things like washing machines, energy bills and clothes." She said, "Many schools routinely help out by discreetly washing clothes and providing items of uniform. This has long been the case, but has become more of an issue following the pandemic and cost of living crisis as more families struggle financially." Julie McCulloch added, "The level of child poverty in the United Kingdom is utterly unacceptable, and the government must do more to tackle the problem."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Leaders of Palestinian-Lebanese resistance movements have gathered together in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, to discuss a range of issues, including anti-Israeli operation by Palestinian groups, as well as Tel Aviv threats. The meeting brought together Secretary General of Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, head of the Hamas political office, Saleh al-Aruri, and Secretary General of the Lebanese Hezbollah Movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah. The three leaders exchanged views on latest political developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as recent Israeli threats. The resistance leaders underlined their unwavering and bedrock support for all resistance groups encountering Israeli occupation. The meeting between resistance leaders comes at a time when tensions are high across the region due to Israeli policies. The occupied Palestinian land, Nablus and Jenin in particular, have been the scene of the regime's raids, resulting in a large number of fatalities. Israeli regime forces attacked Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on July the 3rd, murdering at least 12 Palestinians. They also injured up to 100 others. Some 500 Palestinian families were forced or had to leave their homes due to the Israeli deadly assault. The regime has also carried out numerous raids in the occupied Al-Quds, with settlers backed by Israeli forces killing and injuring Palestinians. Many have described the Israeli intention to carry out those raids in the occupied Al-Quds as seeking to tighten the grip on Palestinian people. But Tel Aviv has not sufficed to that. Israeli officials have made numerous comments calling for more pressure against Palestinians. One significant instance was the Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who repeatedly called for exerting pressure on Palestinian detainees, which has resulted in inmates languishing in regime jails to start hunger strikes to protest the growing Israeli violence. The growing Israeli violence in the occupied territories have simply resulted in rising anti-Israeli operations, with stabbing attacks, rocket strikes, and other sorts of operations being reported almost on a daily basis. Those attacks are only in response to calls by resistance leaders to enhance anti-Israeli operations across the occupied land. Such calls have made the regime officials to threaten to assassinate Palestinian resistance leaders, blaming them for the intensification of resistance against Tel Aviv. Palestinian Hamas movement has reaffirmed that Tel Aviv's threats to assassinate resistance leaders will lead to a confrontation and that the regime will pay its price. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has echoed Hamas' warning, stressing that Israeli threats will only increase Palestinian people and fighters' determination to adhere to the option of resistance in words, actions, and behavior, and to insist on responding to any crime the Israeli regime plans to commit. Additionally, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Freedom Movement, Yasser Khalaf, said that such threats do not frighten the Palestinian people and will not impact the strategy of enhancing and developing the resistance strength and performance. He sent a message to the Israeli leaders not to make wrong calculations regarding the situation, as what awaits them will be far greater than expected. Those calls have been reiterated by Said Hassan Nasrallah, who just recently said that Israel will be returned to the Stone Age if it goes to war with Lebanon. Taking a brief look at those remarks, what they all have in common is that Palestinian resistance is determined to stand firm against Israeli atrocities. This also shows that the resistance has expanded beyond the occupied territories and will continue to expand day after day to the extent which can endanger the future of Israeli occupying regime. Anti-French sentiment is high in Niger as thousands gathered outside the French military base in the capital Niamey to demand the withdrawal of French forces and its ambassadors from the African country. Wearing and waving Niger's flag, demonstrators chanted anti-French slogan, expressing their full support for the country's military government. The demonstrators demanded that Western countries, especially France, respect their choice.
Not our sole demand.
Our only request, our ultimate request, is the departure of the French who are on Niger territory. We don't need these people here. We don't need, and we repeat, we are ready to die to defend our homeland. We are ready to die to get them out. They must leave. We don't need them here.
We're here and we'll be here forever, until the day France packs up, and packs up it will, I tell you. France has to move out because it's not its country. It's our country, it's our territory, and well, France has to move out.
The anger in Niger grew especially after the French president said his country did not recognize the military government there. Emmanuel Macron has said he's in regular contact with Niger's deposed president Mohamed Bazoum. Nigerian junta has blasted Macron's comments, saying their remarks constitute blatant interference in their domestic affairs. But regardless of those reactions, The European Union said it was imposing sanctions against the military junta in Niger as part of efforts to force its leaders to hand over power to a civilian rule.
We have also decided to initiate a process for the establishment of a legal framework for individual sanctions against the putschists, and we are ready to listen to other suggestions from ECOWAS. They explained to us the situation on the ground and how ECOWAS is considering the possibility of a military deployment on the ground.
And instead of expressing support for the people of Niger, who have been under the French colonial rule for decades, Borrell expressed a bloc solidarity with Paris.
The ministers reiterated the strong condemnation of the military coup in Niger, called for the release of President Bazoum and his family, and to go back to the constitutional order. This is something that has been involving, in particular, France. We express our solidarity with France.
The anger and resentment in Niger comes as the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, under the direct influence of France, has threatened to deploy military force in the West African nation in an effort to reinstate ousted President Bazoum. That after the military junta took power following a coup on July 26 and placed President Bazoum under house arrest in what many described as an anti-French revolution in Niger. But what is the root cause of all that hatred against France? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is, according to UN figures, considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all its grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across Africa, but reverberated across Europe. That's due to the fact that Niger is home to its strategic mineral reserves such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. The interesting point, though, is that France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the United States. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate would be waiting for many across other Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they're the ones who should put an end to the decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries.
It's a plot out of a Hollywood movie, but with serious repercussions. The shadow war between Israel and Iran. This one involves an Israeli plot to sabotage Iran's defense industry, including missiles, the biggest military sabotage attempt against Iran in the past 100 years. It is one that failed, however, just in the nick of time. The agency's statement reveals the scope of the operation. The intelligence unit of the Defense Ministry thwarted one of the largest sabotage plots targeting Iran's missile, aviation, and aerospace military industry. This sabotage was carried out under the guidance of the Zionist intelligence services and their agents. A network of agents sought to introduce defective parts into the production of advanced missiles, specifically defective connectors from abroad. The defective parts were discovered by the Defense Ministry Information Protection. The plan was to equip these connectors with explosive circuits. If that was done successfully, the connectors could be programmed to explode remotely at any time. But how was this plot unfoiled?
اون فردی که اشاره کردید که لو داد و اینا میشه مقداری از جزئیاتش اگه امکان داره
بله ایشون یک فرد در واقع غیر نظامی بود خب در همین شبکه خرید بود که شرکت هایی که کار میکرد و ایشون
ایرانی؟
خودش بله ایرانی بود خودش حساس میشه به این که چرا مثلا اون طرف خارجی و اونایی که دارن بهشون این قطعات رو میفروشن این میاد مثلا داخل توزیع میکنه چرا حساس شدن حتی اینها بررسی میکردن توی بازار خرید داخل مراکزی که توزیع کننده این قطعات بودن اطلاعات جمع‌آوری میکردن و ایشون حساس میشه میاد با همکارای ما در سازمان حفاظت اطلاعات در میون میذاره و همکارا چون اطلاعات دیگری هم داشتن بله. که یک علائمی رو از قبل به دست آورده بودن اینها رو تقاطع اطلاعاتی میدن با تقاطع اطلاعاتی و با کمک ایشون بقیه شبکه کم کم تحت شناسایی قرار میگیره منتها به گونه ای که به هیچ وجه موساد و سرویس رژیم صهیونیستی متوجه این اشرافیت اطلاعاتی ایران نشد.
Under the false pretext of preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Mossad has been carrying out a campaign of sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's civilian nuclear program for quite some time. One of the notorious ones was the Stuxnet virus. In April 2011, Iranian government official Ghulam Reza Jalali stated that an investigation had concluded that both the United States and Israel were behind the Stuxnet attack. Mossad has also methodically assassinated and murdered Iranian nuclear scientists from magnetic bombs attached to the side of their cars to the use of poison, and allegedly the use of a killer robot remotely used as an assassin. Additionally, Israel has also targeted Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel's targeting of Iran's defense industry, in particular its drones and missile program, does make sense from Israel's point of view. Iran has made extraordinary advancements in these two fields and military hardware overall. But all of these destructive actions, which Israel has not claimed responsibility for, has not been able to stop Iran's advancements. From Israel's perspective, it makes strategic sense, though only a temporary fix. There's an Iranian saying that says, "Don't play with the lion's tail." Iran may have thwarted these acts of sabotage, but for how long will its patience last when it comes to Israel?
Russia has warned that the West's approval of Ukraine's attacks on Crimea could set the stage for a disastrous war between Moscow and Kiev's Western allies. The warning has been issued by the deputy chairman of Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. The former Russian president has warned any green light to Ukraine's attacks on Crimea entitles Moscow to take action against, quote, each and every NATO member. He added that such an approval would be considered direct legal evidence of the West's complicity in the war against Russia. Medvedev's comments came after a senior Ukrainian official said Washington supports strikes on Crimea if Kiev deems them necessary. Mikhail Podolyak, senior advisor to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, has also said there is absolute consensus amongst Western countries that Kiev can destroy anything that belongs to Russia in territories taken by Moscow. Medvedev has repeatedly warned Kiev that Moscow would have to use a nuclear weapon if Ukrainian forces set foot on Russian territory. Medvedev has said if the West truly supports what Mikhail Podolyak says, it would signal an apocalyptic risk of the end of the world. Moscow has said that the collective West is waging a proxy war against the Russian nation, with the Ukrainian troops under Kiev's command merely providing the cannon fodder for the conflict.
Here you have one country which has 100 million more people than the other country. and has much deeper military industrial capacity can make more missiles, make more bullets, make more tanks than the other country. So over time, the bigger country is almost certain to win, correct? This is a physics principle. Right. It's not a statement of allegiance. You're not a shill for somebody for acknowledging that. If we're wrestling and you outweigh me by 100 pounds, you're probably going to win because you're bigger. That's a fact.
Meanwhile, the Biden administration is working to reach a deal with Ukraine for long-term military support to keep backing the war with Russia. According to media reports, the commitments would make it difficult for a future president to exit. The effort is part of a commitment made by G7 nations at the recent NATO summit in Vilnius to negotiate their own bilateral security deals with Ukraine. Besides the G7 nations, 18 other countries have agreed to provide long-term military support for Kiev.
The United States, NATO, and the EU are on the wrong path. And at the very most, it could lead to their destruction. And at the very least, it will destroy the euro, it will destroy the dollar, it will destroy the Western economy.
Reports say Western officials are looking for ways to lock in pledges of support and limit future governments' abilities to backtrack. Amid fears in European capitals that Donald Trump, if he recaptures the White House, will seek to scale back the aid. The United States has announced $250 million in fresh military aid to Ukraine. The package is said to include equipment for clearing mines and obstacles, as well as missiles, artillery rounds, anti-armor missiles, and more than 3 million rounds of small arms ammunition. Kiev has already received more than $43 billion from the U.S. in the form of weapon systems like howitzers and millions of rounds of ammunition, including widely banned cluster munitions since last February when Russia started a special military operation in Ukraine. The flow of arms to Ukraine has raised concerns in some European capitals. Former Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte has said NATO's strategy regarding the conflict in Ukraine has not led to the outcome desired by the alliance, and the economic sanctions imposed on Russia have not crippled its economy. According to Conte, the strategy pursued so far in NATO, based on constant military supplies to Ukraine and the logic of escalation, did not lead to a military defeat for Russia. The US and its allies have pledged to give Ukraine F-16 fighter jets, but military experts now believe jets are not going to be a silver bullet for Kiev.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Democratic Senator from Virginia, Tim Kaine, says a clause on insurrection against the Constitution could preclude former President Donald Trump from running in next year's election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNN, cable news network, has covered this story and tells us more. Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine said on Sunday, 3rd of September, there's a powerful argument to be made for barring Donald Trump from the presidential ballot based on the 14th Amendment's ban on insurrectionists holding public office. My sense is it's probably going to get resolved in the courts of law, Senator Kaine said on ABC's This Week program, adding that Democrats' focus should be on winning in 2024. Legal experts have pointed to the 14th Amendment as a potential long-shot avenue to keep Donald Trump from becoming president. The amendment includes a post-Civil War disqualification clause that bars anyone from holding public office if they have engaged in insurrection or rebellion. The U.S. Constitution does not, however, spell out how to enforce this ban, and it has only been applied twice since the late 1800s, when it was used extensively against former Confederates. Election officials in battleground states, including attorneys general in Michigan and New Hampshire, have said they're anticipating outside groups to file lawsuits on the matter and are studying the legality of the provision and how it may disqualify Donald Trump from appearing on ballots in their states. Liberal activists have championed the 14th Amendment's disqualification clause and have already vowed to file lawsuits to disqualify the former president, a tactic they have used against other elected officials to little success, though some prominent conservative legal scholars have recently endorsed the idea. Senator Tim Kaine voiced support for the idea, saying, "The language of the amendment is specific. If you give aid and comfort to those who engage in an insurrection against the Constitution of the United States, it doesn't say against the United States, it says against the Constitution. In my view, the attack on the Capitol on that day was designed for a particular purpose, and that was to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power as is laid out in the Constitution." Senator Kaine also said that he had discussed using the provision with fellow senators during Donald Trump's second impeachment in 2021, remarking that he thought it would have been a more productive way to go to do a declaration under that section of the 14th Amendment. He floated the idea of a censure vote in Congress under the 14th Amendment as an alternative way of holding Donald Trump accountable and keeping him from holding public office again after the Senate acquitted the former president in a failed impeachment vote. 7 Republican senators joined the chamber's 50 Democratic senators and independent members in finding Donald Trump guilty of inciting a riot on 6 of January 2021. Senator Kaine noted that Virginia will host its own races later this year to decide the makeup of its split legislature in an election that will act as a window into the state of politics in the battleground state ahead of next year's presidential race. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia said that he believes there is a powerful argument to be made that Donald Trump can be disqualified from running in the 2024 presidential election under the 14th Amendment. "In my view, the attack on the Capitol on that day was designed for a particular purpose at a particular moment, and that was to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power as is laid out in the Constitution." Senator Kaine was speaking to ABC's George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, 3rd of September. He said, "So I think there is a powerful argument to be made." Senator Kaine, who in 2016 ran for vice president alongside Hillary Clinton, said that the language is specific, referring to the third section of the 14th Amendment. "If you give aid and comfort to those who engage in an insurrection against the Constitution of the United States, it doesn't say against the United States, it says against the Constitution of the United States." According to the section, no person shall be an elector of president and vice president or hold any public office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. It adds that such a clause could be removed via a vote of 2/3 in each House of Congress. Speaking to George Stephanopoulos, Senator Kaine said that He discussed the section with colleagues at the time of Donald Trump's second impeachment. He said, "I thought actually it might have been a more productive way to go than the second impeachment to do a declaration under a section of the 14th Amendment." Senator Kaine joins a growing number of legal experts looking to prevent Donald Trump from running for office again under the 14th Amendment. An article by two conservative law professors that is set to be published in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review examines the clause in light of Donald Trump's involvement in the 2020 election subversion efforts. The article, written by constitutional scholars William Bode and Michael Stokes Paulson, concludes, "Taking Section 3 seriously means that its constitutional disqualifications from future state and federal office holding extend to participants in the attempted overturning of the presidential election of 2020, including former President Donald Trump, as well as others." Meanwhile, a similar article published last month in The Atlantic by retired conservative federal judge Michael Luttig and Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Lawrence Tribe echoed similar sentiments. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered this same story and tells us more. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia on Sunday, 3rd of September, said that he believes a strong legal argument can be made to use the 14th Amendment to remove former President Donald Trump from the ballot in 2024, citing Trump's actions related to the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Shortly after 6th of January 2021, Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives for inciting an insurrection amid his push to overturn his election loss, with 10 Republicans and all Democrats voting to impeach him. He denied any wrongdoing, and while 7 members of his own Republican Party joined Democrats to support his conviction, he was ultimately acquitted by the Senate. "In my view, the attack on the Capitol on that day was designed for a particular purpose at a particular moment, and that was to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power as is laid out in the Constitution," Senator Kaine said on Sunday. "So I think there's a powerful argument to be made here. The language is specific," Senator Kaine argued, referring to a section of the amendment that states that someone isn't eligible for future office if, while they were previously in office, they took an oath to support the Constitution, but then engaged in insurrectional rebellion against the same, or gave aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, unless they are granted amnesty by a 2/3 vote in the Houses of Congress. Some legal scholars and advocacy groups agree that would include Donald Trump, though similar efforts against other Republicans have failed. A Trump campaign spokesman previously called the potential use of the 14th Amendment blatant election interference. Senator Kaine of Virginia, a former vice presidential nominee, said on This Week program that his congressional colleagues had debated using the 14th Amendment to remove Donald Trump from office, rather than pursuing a second impeachment in the wake of the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. He said he thought at the time that it might have been a more productive way to go.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to English translation of a speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, regarding Arba'in Walk as a divine phenomenon. Usually in such phenomena like Arba'in Walk, which has not been promoted in any way, by which suddenly emerges before one's eyes, the divine hand is more visible than in other phenomena. Notice how much effort in propaganda is made in the world in order to gather 10,000 or 50,000 individuals in one place. But in the end, they are unable to do so. In our country, despite the existence of many obstacles, 2 million people go to Karbala by way of an 80-kilometer walk. They walk, but they do not go there to enjoy themselves and to rest in a hotel. And a crowd of people several times larger than this goes to Karbala from within Iraq and from other countries. This is a divine event. This is a divine phenomenon. This shows that this path is the path of love. However, it is not a blind love. Rather, it is a kind of love that is marked by insight, such as the love the friends of God have for God. O God, feed me with your love, and the love of whomsoever loves you, and the love of all those actions that help me to get closer to you. Bihar al-Anwar, Volume 91, page 149. This affection and this love is accompanied by insight. A person with such love knows and understands things, and this attraction and magnetic power pulls him.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The phenomenon of Arba'in is an indescribable, unprecedented phenomenon. This extraordinary movement is a great, astonishing demonstration. There is nothing like it in the world. Western powers cannot understand what this movement means. They cannot absorb it. That is why you have witnessed how they have remained silent since the beginning. They have hatched a plot of silence. While the Western powers and media expose every little move that takes place in the world, they have not mentioned this huge movement of the people for years. Only recently they have mentioned it a little, but their analyses were hostile and erroneous. From the viewpoint of the believers who walk on this path, their analyses were ridiculous. The likes of the English media and the other such media presented hostile analysis. This shows that the bubbling of this blessed spring has caused them to become extremely agitated. Thus, they are unable to analyze it. The significance of the first Arba'in lay in that it was the powerful voice of Ashura. From Ashura to Arba'in, when the household of the Prophet of Allah returned to Karbala, these 40 days were 40 days of the command of the logic of truth amidst the dark world of evil rulers and the Umayyad dynasty. The true voice was the outcry of Zainab al-Kubra and the outcry of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. But where? In Kufa and in the Levant, where complete darkness existed. These were the strongest voices. These were the voices that preserved Ashura. Oh, Allah.
Through all my years I've been lost Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
King's Pilgrimaging on Foot, Esmail Stenzel, 47 years old, from Germany. Arba'in is a day of pilgrimage to the shrine of the Chief of Martyrs, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him, in Karbala, Iraq. Literally, millions of pilgrims converge every year on Karbala in Iraq to mourn the Chief of Martyrs. This movement is so huge, with tens of millions of pilgrims converging on Karbala, that many of them on foot, that even those who deny or those who do not believe in the Chief of Martyrs often ask, who is Imam Hussein? In this mini-series of programs, we look at pilgrims from non-Muslim countries who have taken part in the Great Arba'in Walk, converging on Karbala. This is their story in their own words. Today, we look at how a 47-year-old German man, Esmail Stenzel, converted to Islam, and Imam Hussein's role in his conversion to Islam. Please stay with us. I'm Esmail Stenzel, 47 years old, from Germany. I was born in Nuremberg, Germany. I used to be a Protestant Christian. Protestants are strongly linked and believe fervently in Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, and thus I believed in one God and one Prophet, that is, Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. However, when I attended a church service, I had no special feeling and I couldn't communicate with God. It felt as if a church was just like any other place, and there was nothing special about it. Events which happened in a church gave me no special feeling. One day, I went to buy a pizza at a fast food restaurant. I knew very well one of the people who worked in the restaurant. His name was Muzaffar. He was a German citizen, a young man of Turkish origin. I often went to the restaurant for pizzas and sandwiches. On that day, Muzaffar told me he wanted to go to a mosque. I asked him, "Where is the mosque?" He said, "The mosque is where we go at nights to pray and worship God." That night, I accompanied Muzaffar to the mosque. He sat me down in the mosque, brought me tea and coffee, and gave me two books to read. One was about the sermons and sayings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, that is, the Nahjul Balagha. And the other was a book about the hadiths, or narrations, about the Imams, peace be upon them. He then stood for prayer, or salat. I I observed in detail Muzaffar's nighttime prayer in the mosque. I observed his general demeanour and the way he prayed. I thought to myself, how wonderful, he seems very calm and very reassured. This was exactly the feeling I was searching for when I prayed in a church, a feeling which was always missing in the church, but that night I had that feeling in a mosque. This question was always at the back of my mind. What is the correct way to pray to God? The question of how to worship God and how to pray to God was something that I always wanted to know, and that night I found the answer in a mosque as I watched Muzaffar's ruku and sujood, that is, genuflection and prostration in prayer. Right then, I felt that Muzaffar was right, and this is the correct way to worship God Almighty and to pray to God. After watching Muzaffar pray, I read some pages of the two books that Muzaffar had given me. With each page that I read, I felt a new window or a new door had opened up for me. Much later on, I realized that the Almighty answers the questions that are in our hearts slowly and little by little. I felt as if I needed to read the Holy Quran. That is when I went to a bookstore which was owned by a Turkish person. There, I bought the Holy Quran and I started to read it. One of the best things that we could do for other human beings is to pray for them. All humans need to communicate to God and pray to God. One of the best role models that we have is the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and also members of his household or Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. They are the best models that we can follow. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, is also an excellent model. And the pilgrimage on Arba'in to Imam Hussein's shrine in Karbala is one of these best models. When I compare the life of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, with the life of Prophet Jesus, I see that how much hardship Imam Hussein had to endure. The Imam, together with all his children, relatives and companions, were martyred in Karbala. The troops of Yazid the tyrant set fire to the camp of Imam Hussein. I can see that Imam Hussein and his movement is the way to salvation for all human beings.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew since not